never fall at all. They're tough as sin. Let nobody in. They turn and spin your wheels, and nobody wins. Coincidence and likely stars, they dog your trail like a pack of lies. They whine at night when the lights around you toss and turn. You pitch and roll disinformation. You spin it like a silkworm.
This is Democracy Now!
We have clear scientific evidence they work, and they are our best defense. I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine.
I think he made a mistake when he said that. It's just incorrect information.
As the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 nears 200,000, President Trump spars with the head of the Centers for Disease Control over the importance of wearing masks to stop the spread of the virus. We'll speak to Dr. Monica Gandhi, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, then to David Goodrich, a former climate scientist with NOAA, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. His new book, A Voyage Across an Ancient Ocean, a bicycle journey through the Northern Dominion of Oil. Then President Trump calls for the teaching of, quote, patriotic education, alleging there's left-wing indoctrination in the nation's schools.
Our children are instructed from propaganda tracts like those of Howard Zinn that try to make students ashamed of their own history.
We'll hear from the late historian Howard Zinn in his own words.
We tell kids that Columbus, whom they have been told was a great hero, Columbus mutilated Indians and kidnapped them and killed them in pursuit of gold. Should we tell people that Theodore Roosevelt, who is held up as one of our great presidents, was really a warmonger who loved military exploits and who congratulated an American general who committed a massacre in the Philippines? Should we tell young people that? And I think the answer is we should be honest with young people. We should not deceive them.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House scuttled a plan to distribute 650 million cloth face masks to every residents in the United States during the early weeks of the coronavirus pandemic. That's according to The Washington Post, which reports Vice President Pence and other officials rejected the proposal because, quote, receiving masks might create concern or panic. A draft press release about the plan from the U.S. Postal Service reads, the first shipments are expected to reach U.S. households as early as April XX, with the date left incomplete. One study by the Center for Economic Policy Research found widespread mask use across the United States would have saved 40,000 lives in the months of April and May alone. The official U.S. death toll from COVID-19 is rapidly approaching 200,000, with more than 6.6 million confirmed coronavirus cases. On Thursday, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio delayed delayed the start of in-person classes for K through 12 students until at least the end of September amidst a major staffing shortage in schools and teacher protests about coronavirus safety measures. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports a recommendation by the CDC to radically scale back coronavirus testing was not written by scientists and was published over their strenuous objections. Last month, the CDC's website quietly changed its guidance to recommend people without symptoms should not be tested, even if they've been in close contact with an infected person. The new CDC guidelines contain basic scientific errors, suggesting they were drafted by a political operative rather than an expert in infectious diseases. One unnamed federal official told the New York Times, quote, "That was a doc that came from the top down from Health and Human Services and the White House task force," they said. President Trump's personal lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, has threatened to sue scores of Stanford professors and researchers after they published an open letter denouncing the qualifications of Scott Atlas, a colleague at Stanford who's now advising Trump on the pandemic. Atlas is a neuroradiologist with no expertise in infectious diseases. The Washington Post recently reported Atlas is pushing Trump to promote a controversial herd immunity strategy, which could result in the deaths of millions more Americans. In an open letter, the Stanford doctors, epidemiologists, infectious disease docs, and researchers wrote of Dr. Atlas, quote, "The guidance he is giving to the White House does not reflect sound epidemiological reasoning, nor is it consistent with the current body of scientific knowledge about COVID-19. Attorney Mark Kasowitz, who's now representing Atlas, has threatened to sue signatories of the open letter and has demanded a retraction by today, saying the letter maliciously defames his client. Stanford professor Michael Fishbach responded to the threat by writing on Twitter, quote, "I stand by everything we said, more facts, more science, less Kasowitz." Full disclosure, my brother, Dr. Steve Goodman, is a dean at the Stanford School of Medicine, one of the signatories to that letter. Globally, confirmed cases of coronavirus have topped 30 million. India recorded another 96,000 new cases over the last 24 hours, putting the nation of 1.3 billion on track to surpass the United States within weeks as the country with the highest number of infections. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is warning of a new wave of coronavirus cases across Europe, with more than 300,000 new infections in the last week alone. The WHO says the surge reflects not only more comprehensive testing, but alarming rates of community spread across the continent. Back in the United States, the Department of Labor is reporting another 860,000 workers filed for new unemployment benefits last week. Since the pandemic began, around 60 million jobless claims have been filed, a new record. Meanwhile, the total net worth of the nation's billionaires has soared by nearly $850 billion since mid-March, a 29% increase. That's according to a new study by the Institute for Policy Studies. This comes as a new poll conducted by NPR and researchers at Harvard finds economic fallout from the pandemic has hit communities of color the hardest. The study found 72% of Latinx households, 60% of Black households, 55% of Native American households have reported serious financial problems this year, with trouble paying for food, housing, and debt. A federal judge in Washington state's temporarily blocked the U.S. Postal Service from new operational changes that have slowed down mail delivery ahead of the election. Judge Stanley Bastian accused President Trump and Postmaster General Louis DeJoy of being, quote, "involved in a politically motivated attack on the efficiency of the Postal Service." He also said the changes created a, quote, "substantial possibility many voters will be disenfranchised," unquote. On Thursday, Trump continued to cast doubt on mail-in voting. In a tweet, he wrote, "The November 3rd election result may never be accurately determined, which is what some want," unquote. Twitter flagged Trump's tweet and provided information about how voting by mail is safe and legal. A former top aide on the White House Coronavirus Task Force has announced she's voting for Joe Biden, claiming President Trump has shown a, quote, "flat-out disregard for human life," unquote. Olivia Troy served as Vice President Mike Pence's lead staffer on the task force from February until July. Troy is featured in a new ad by Republican voters against Trump.
Middle of February, we knew it wasn't a matter of if COVID would become a big pandemic here in the United States. It was a matter of when. But the president didn't want to hear that because his biggest concern was that we were in election year and how is this going to affect what he considered to be his record of success. It was shocking to see the president saying that the virus was a hoax, saying that everything's okay when we know that it's not. The truth is he doesn't actually care about anyone else but himself.
In Bolivia, self-proclaimed interim president Jeanine Añez has suspended her campaign for president in an attempt to unify conservative votes against the MAS party, formerly led by ousted longtime president Evo Morales. This comes less than a year after the extremist right-wing leader rose to power following a military coup against Morales. Añez's reign has been marked by skyrocketing military and police repression and violence against indigenous communities and supporters of Morales. The presidential election is scheduled for October 18th. In Russia, aides to opposition leader Alexei Navalny said Thursday German scientists discovered traces of the banned nerve agent Novichok on a water bottle in the Siberian hotel room where Navalny stayed before falling ill aboard a flight to Moscow last month. Navalny is a vocal critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. He survived the apparent poisoning and was airlifted to a hospital in Germany where he's recovering after coming out of an induced coma. A warning to our audience. The following headline contains graphic descriptions of sexual assault. Another woman has stepped forward to accuse Donald Trump of unwanted sexual contact. Amy Doris says Trump cornered her and assaulted her at the U.S. Open tennis tournament in 1997. She spoke with The Guardian in an interview published Thursday.
He just grabbed me and he just shoved his tongue down my throat and I was pushing him off. And then that's when his grip became tighter and, you know, his hands were kind of like very gropey and all over, you know, my butt, my breast, my back, like everything. But he was just like his grip was hard. You know, you couldn't pull away. I was pushing his tongue out of my mouth with my teeth. It was pretty traumatic.
Amy Doris joins at least 25 other women who've accused Trump of some form of sexual misconduct, with over a dozen claiming sexual assault. In 2005, Trump was caught on a hot mic recorded by the show Access Hollywood, boasting about sexually assaulting women.
Use some Tic Tacs just in case they start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Florida, a lawsuit involving 15 prisoners, alleges rampant sexual violence from guards at Federal Correctional Complex Coleman, one of the largest federal prisons in the country. The women say the abuse lasted for years, dating back to 2012, and that they were threatened by guards with being transferred to prisons with worse conditions if they spoke out or didn't comply. At least six of the accused officers have admitted in government court filings to engaging in sexual misconduct at the Florida prison. None of the guards have been prosecuted. Instead, they were allowed to resign or retire, and some still receive benefits. One of the accused guards worked at the prison until 2019. A new report by immigration rights advocates highlights an alarming pattern of human rights violations against pregnant and postpartum asylum seekers in the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection during the pandemic. Some of the accounts include a Guatemalan asylum seeker who was forced to give birth next to a trash can while still wearing pants, and a pregnant Honduran asylum seeker who was expelled to Mexico while she was having contractions. This follows shocking reports that a doctor at an ICE jail in Georgia has been performing hysterectomies on immigrant women without their consent. The House of Representatives has passed the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, requiring U.S. employers to make reasonable accommodations to people who are pregnant. Over 100 Republicans joined majority Democrats in Thursday's roll call. Labor rights advocates are demanding Republicans take up the bill in the Senate, where Majority Leader Mitch McConnell remains focused on pushing through Trump's judicial nominees, eight of whom have been confirmed this week to lifetime appointments on the federal bench. A warning to our viewers, the following story contains disturbing images of police violence. In Utah, a Salt Lake City police officer has been charged with felony aggravated assault after body camera footage showed him ordering a police dog to attack a black man who was on his knees with his hands in the air. Prosecutors say 36-year-old Jeffrey Ryans was not resisting arrest and posed no threat to officers before the April assault, which left Ryans with severe nerve and tendon damage to his leg. If convicted, Officer Nicholas Pierce faces up to 15 years in prison. President Trump lashed out Thursday at educators who teach about the United States' history of slavery and racism, announcing a so-called patriotic education plan to combat what Trump called toxic propaganda in schools. Trump was speaking at the National Archives Museum in Washington.
The left-wing rioting and mayhem are the direct result of decades of left-wing indoctrination in our schools. It's gone on far too long. Our children are instructed from propaganda tracks like those of Howard Zinn that try to make students ashamed of their own history.
President Trump was referencing Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. In response, the Zinn Education Project tweeted, "So what explains the rebellions in 1676, 1680, 1786, 1831, 1859, and more by Native Americans, enslaved Africans, coal mines, and more? Howard Zinn wasn't alive then," they tweeted. Trump also called the teaching of critical race theory a form of child abuse and lashed out at the 1619 Project, the Pulitzer Prize-winning series which reexamines the legacy of slavery. On Twitter, 1619 creator Nicole Hannah-Jones pointed out, quote, "The White House Conference on American History has not a single black historian on it. Strange," she wrote. We'll hear the late historian Howard Zinn in his own words later in the program. And two more federal executions are scheduled for next week at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. One of the prisoners, Christopher Villalva, is being put to death for a crime he committed when he was 19 years old. This is Villalva in his own words in a rare video from death row.
"People are not being informed about the racial disparity on the federal death row. Black people are only 13% of this country's population, yet we are almost half the population of federal death row. Now I'm making my plea to the American public to rethink the federal death penalty. The Democratic Party claims they want to abolish the death penalty, yet no politicians have said anything about federal death row. Public figures, lawyers, and abolitionists are nowhere to be found in the national media on the subject of capital punishment, yet men are being paraded to the federal death house right now."
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Thank you. With your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us. I am delighted to have one of my heroes, Sylvia Federici, the author of Revolution at Point Zero, Housework, Reproduction, and Feminist Struggle. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Sylvia.
Oh, thank you, Sylvia, for inviting me.
Talk a little about the way we as women ubicate ourselves within this idea of reproduction and reproductive work.
Yes, and by the way, it's very interesting, this question, because in the last weeks, because of this epidemic, because so many people have been pushed back in the home, and so also women who have jobs outside the home, now the difficulty of reconciling the two is intensified. Often you have to carry on your work and then also the work in the home with the children, etc. You know, the question of reproduction, I think that it's in moments of crisis like this that we can see more than ever how important it is. And also how we have been living now for so long, at least many, the majority of women in a state of permanent crisis. Because, you know, reproduction is the activity that, in a way, you know, carries on life on a day-to-day basis, makes it possible for us, you know, to keep on living and to thrive, you know, whether it is child raising or even cleaning and cooking and emotional work and sexual work. At the same time, as important and potentially creative, this work has been, taken over, appropriated, you know, the employer class, capitalism, you know, and bent to the needs of the labor market, to the needs of the exploitation of labor. So we are carrying on a work that is potentially, you know, very satisfying and very creative, but in conditions that we do not control, and in conditions that make it very oppressive, that isolate us, you know. It's a very individualizing work because we are all, you know, isolated in our home. And also it's a work that is given no recognition. In fact, it's not even considered real work. And people say, oh, do you have a job? Do you go out to work? You know, assuming that in the home, it's just the question of nature. And, you know, it's a work that is done in condition that majority of women is terrible. You have no space in the house. You have no resources, no money, often having to work outside the home. So you have a double shift. I believe that it's very, very important, you know, particularly for the feminist movement. When we think of changing the society, when we think of social change, and particularly in situations like now, that make it very, very clear that we need a social change, because this epidemic is bringing to light, is revealing all the contradictions, all the crises with which we live on a day-to-day basis, whether it is housing, for example. You know, we are told to do social distancing, and most people, because of the high cost of rent, you know, are living crammed in apartments where you cannot have any social distances. And the lack of resources, the fact that we have to rely on food that is probably full of pesticides. Agriculture has been so industrialized. Food crops, is now an industrial process. You know, so we are eating pesticides, herbicides. So all of that, it's making, for example, going shopping. I experience all the time, and I don't even have children. You know, you don't know if what you're buying is transgenic, how it has been cultivated, and also, you know, what happened to the workers who made those crops. You now buy crops that have been produced hundreds and hundreds of miles away, and you don't know how much blood has gone into that production. So I think that we need a really a major restructuring of the logic that is governing this society, which is a logic that devalues reproduction work, and because it really devalues people's life. It really devalues people's life and only care for what they call the real economy, really care for, you know, individual wealth accumulation, corporate power, the whole capitalist accumulation of wealth. And this is why life for so many people, you know, has become so miserable. Even before this now pandemic, I've been living in a state of constant crisis. You know, you have fires in the forest, half of the world is burning, because they're making space for raising more cattle. You know, you have an epidemic of cancer. Look at the cancer statistic every year in the United States. Far, 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 far more than those who are dying, you know, of coronavirus. Cancer has become now an epidemic. You hardly have anybody who doesn't know a friend, who doesn't have gone, you know, through the experience of having a cancer. And this is because what we eat is so contaminated, so polluted. You know, we eat meat from animals that have been packed in the thousands, and so every day are full of pathogens. Then they have to be given antibiotics, you know, so that the meat does not kill us immediately. But in the end, it kills us through the cancers that are now multiplying like a real epidemic. But nobody talks about it because you cannot touch the meat industry. Like nobody talks about the deforestation that is also contributing to climate change. So the animals are moving from one area to the other, and they are communicating diseases that before they were not. Nobody's talking about the agriculture that now is full of pesticides and, you know, carried on with fumigation, etc., which also is contributing to destroy our immunity system. So I think what this epidemic is bringing to light, it's really the reproduction crisis that we have been, you know, and at the very core of this reproduction crisis is the devaluation, which has been a devaluation of women's life. Because the devaluation of reproduction, since women have been, at least in the history of capitalism, have been really the main subject of reproductive work. Now many women have jobs outside the home, and since the 80s also, because so many women have also gone out to work, you know, there's been a lot of you know, the organization of importing labor, you know, women, migrant workers coming to do domestic work, you know, from countries that have been impoverished, so that women many times don't have an alternative but to migrate to give a better future to their children. But whoever is performing this work is essential.
Yes.
So we're talking about the essential economy, essential work. It's very interesting that nobody talks about the work that is going on inter home as essential work as well. And of course, women are the essential worker, whether it is the nurses, whether it is, you know, the people who are cultivating food, or whether it is the people who are providing reproduction in the home. It's really the women have been at the center of this crisis. And so my view is that it's hopefully we will be able to turn the table and turn this crisis into a moment of education, into a moment of consciousness raising, to the conclusion that we really have to reorganize reproduction and reorganize the logic, reorganize and change qualitatively, drastically, the logic that is governing the function of this system.
One of the gifts you have given us as a collective is a very clear and a very succinct description of what the system we live under is, you know. I love that you talk about how capitalism has been portrayed to us as a necessary evil, this idea that it was a natural process that liberated workers from the tyranny of labor.
And the contrary.
And so I wonder if you could talk about how not only it is the contrary, but how the capitalist system, just like colonization, has become normalized in our society, and it has just become this way of being where valorization of human life comes out of the ability to be exploited, to produce for the capitalist system.
That's so central, because when I say that capitalism is not progress, promise of actually improving the condition of humanity and also eliminating the most brutal forms of work, you can actually see there is a complete historical lie, and you can see from the history of capitalism, which begins with slavery, begins with the expropriation of the peasantry from the land in Europe, and it begins with the enslavement of millions of people. And not only, and that enslavement have lasted for 3 centuries, way beyond the beginning of capitalism. You could say, oh, well, it was an accident. No, it was not an accident, because it lasted into the 19th century, the century of enlightenment, the century of the so-called democratic revolution, the French Revolution, equality, fraternity. There was slavery. Actually, those who made the French Revolution, you know, were people who had gained so much power. It's a beautiful book by C.L.R. James, The Black Jacobins, that documents all of this, showing that the protagonists of the French Revolution were, in fact, those French, you know, business people who had enriched themselves through the slave trade, and they had gained so much economic power that they could defy, you know, the aristocracy. And then the whole history through the 19th century and 20th century is an history of colonization, is a history of the most brutal, brutal forms of exploitation. In the Congo, the rubber industry that was the center of the auto industry, they would cut the hands and cut the arms, you know, of the workers in the Congo, and thousands died if they were not sufficiently productive. All the history of colonialism, and then you look at Europe, and then you see 50 million, 2 world wars, 50 million people, and when you look at it in a historical perspective, you see that the whole destruction of life was actually very functional to destroy peasant Europe, to prepare the workforce for industrialization. The actually industrialization was the result, you know, of the 2 wars, on a massive scale, producing a whole new proletariat, you know, that had gone through the discipline of the army and now was ready for the discipline, you know, of the factory. And And colonization continue. We are living in a colonial system. I often become very skeptical when people in the university speak of post-colonial or decolonial. There's nothing post-colonial in our society. When you look at the international division of labor, you see that it's completely colonial. In fact, the what we call neoliberalism applied to Africa, Latin America, the process of structural adjustment, this was a process of recolonization. And we have to see the colonialism, like capitalist production in general, as never the same form. Of course, it changes depending on the different changes of capitalist production and the labor market. But when you look at, you know, colonialism today, you know, countries in Africa, they might not have the British or the French flag on the top of their government building. But all their economy, all their social structuring, it's completely depending on the international monetary system. And it's completely dependent on the decision of the World Bank and the IMF. They don't have any autonomy. And even if they have a kind of, you know, perfunctory presence at the United Nations, they always vote to, you know, with the block where their money is coming from. So, and we see the division of labor. I mean, who is doing the most unpaid, precarious, dangerous, unrecognized, and vulnerable jobs in American society or in Europe for that matter? You know, it's people from Latin America, it's people from Asia, the Caribbean island. I mean, we only have a colonial organization of the division of labor. We are going to go from the catastrophe of the pandemic to the catastrophe of a lot of people having no money, no job, no security, and nobody is going to face this in a more brutal way, the immigrant people. You know, on top of it, have to be afraid of going to a hospital because of ICE and be afraid of being deported. The cruelty of this system, there's no words to describe it. And I always feel very, very cynical and suspicious when I hear all this concern about, you know, our health care. The concern, I think, is for something else, because much of the suffering that we are experiencing today is the result of policies that were very consciously implemented. The lack of preparation, for instance, was not, you know, an accident, was not an oversight, right? But there was a decision, for instance, not to invest in certain services and invest in other, not to invest in what was most important to people, reproduction, and so that we could be prepared in front of an emergency, but to invest in what would be, you know, most profitable.
You know, people think the capitalist system is necessary now, is part of our lives, and we have to do whatever to keep it afloat. So we've seen multiple crises where governments are forced to donate their GDP, their entire growth production.
Oh, yeah.
And how we saw how in 2008, Obama, who everybody has hailed as being almost saintly, gave the entire wealth of the United States to the bankers. So I'm curious as to where you see this, because we've never recovered from that so-called crisis. And so this little this pause that has been imposed has, of course, had some benefit in that we are seeing who the essential workers are, you know, the women who produce
yes.
all the services, the women who are in the homes cooking nonstop today, and also the nurses, the doctors, the people serving food. But we also see how this pause is causing a lot of the small entrepreneurs out of business. And what happens
yes.
usually after a downturn is the bankers, the people with wealth come in like vultures, you know, and they take everything that goes into foreclosure, right? So what I'm looking at is a world that we may wake up, you know, 2 months or 3 months into after we so-called it safe to go out again, into a world where more capitalist concentration has occurred.
Capitalism has learned to use, you know, crisis and to produce crisis when they need them, to use them and to produce them in order to restructure itself. You know, in the 30s, Schumpeter was a famous economist. He spoke of creative destruction. The capitalism has to go through a period of creative destruction, which is a period in which they somehow cut the dry branches from their trees. You know, they restructure in a way of eliminating all those jobs and activities that are not profitable any longer because they're pacing, you know, they're moving to a new phase. And so there's no question, and we already see the outline, you know, the outline, first of all, the major, a new transfer of wealth from below, you know, to the top. You know, the famous help, as usual, as in 2008, is actually helping the bank and then the big company, the corporation, and not the small shops that are waiting there, like, you know, the parched land is waiting for the rain, because they know that if the help doesn't come on the next in time, they are going to shut down. And I think that's what they want. They want to really do away with a lot of small business so that there will be the hegemony of the corporation, the big chain of food. We already see the trend, and that's going to accelerate. And also the organization of work. Already, and not only in the United States. I mean, I was talking to my sister this morning who is in Italy, and she was saying that in Italy, too, now they are saying that a lot of the classroom for the future, not just during the epidemic, are going to be online because this is going to be so much cheap. So the whole experience, you know, maybe the classroom experience will be reserved to a few, to the happy few, you know, those who can afford to go to certain universities. But more and more, particularly at the so-called lower level, take of the community colleges. So we can already see the outline, how they're going. And the bigger question is, you know, that the kind of catastrophe that we can already foresee adding up to the health crisis, you know, in terms of people's life, you know, it's somehow also a product of the fact that for some time now, the capitalist class has been complaining that their rates of profit are not high enough. And this is something that has been going on, and I believe that much of the restructuring that is going to take place will also be done from this point of view. For the last 30 years, you know, the international capital has really put the world, turned the world upside down. You know, neoliberalism has forced government to disinvest in some of the most essential services and programs that people have, you know, and this across the globe. They have imposed the most brutal austerity program, monetary devaluation. Nevertheless, they are complaining that their rate of profit is not high enough. And one of the way that it has manifested itself is that the interest rate of money on, you know, when you go, has dropped to zero, which is an anomaly because normally in the last century it's been 3 to 4 percent. Now it's zero, which means that actually, there's been, before the epidemic, there's been a reluctance to invest. And that reluctance is connected to the perception that the profit rate is not high enough. So when we look historically how, you know, capitalism has tried to adjust the profit rate to what they consider important, that means the application of even more brutal forms of exploitation.
So in Latin America, I grew up during the war times and the dirty wars of the 80s. And for us, it meant going from being hungry to starving. You know, it just meant this... Oh, overnight inflation, this overnight violence, you know, and bombs that started raining on people who dissented and, you know, went against the government. And not only am I concerned about the idea of austerity going on steroids, and for people who don't understand what austerity, we're talking about how governments cut their spending on healthcare, on education, on any, you know, housing, that which has been elusive for the, you know, almost two decades now in Canada. I'm also concerned about this idea of imposing massive vaccination, of forcing people into isolation, because for social movements, our immunity has always been community. You know, for us in Latin America,
absolutely.
So if you could talk a little bit about how do we, in this time of crisis, because I think also crisis also wakes us up as movements. You know, we this is also vitamins for us, because it's not just the capitalist system that gets reinforced by this. The people who also see, you know, the sand shifting beneath our feet, we get motivated. You know, this stressful moments
absolutely
is actually what move us.
You know, and it's very good, because I think what we're already seeing on two levels, and this, in fact, is the hope. Because, in fact, I was going to say before, in conclusion to my point, was that I think it's very, very important, as, in fact, you know, we are responding to the crisis, and the response is already very, very strong. But as we are responding, I think it's very important to respond in a way that doesn't look at the crisis as something that is temporary, so that we have to deal with this crisis so that we go back to something. Because in reality, when you look, I was making a connection between what is happening now and this whole story of, you know, capitalist complaint about the rate of profit, to say that we should not delude ourselves that things are going to improve unless there is a major, major mobilization. That, in fact, that we are going to go back. And there is a good slogan now, you know, let's not talk about going back to normality, because normality was the problem. Normality was already a problem. So it's very important to look at responding now, for instance, all the forms of mutual aid, which is really fantastic what is happening. You know, people bringing food, people bringing, you know, masks and helping and the support for nurses, but also looking at the future and see that we have to create communitarian forms of reproduction, more communitarian, and we have to struggle to gain the resources to make that possible. That the way our reproduction has been organized, and this is a theme that has been very central to my work, and it's been inspired by what I've seen mostly in Latin America, because people have gone through so many crises that have really raised the, you know, question of life and death. And I think they have understood that except through communitarian work and communitarian forms of reproduction, they had no chance to survive. And so when you go to Latin America today, you already see the beginning of a whole set of structures that are not only enabling people to survive, but they also give you the sense of a new society. They give you the sense of another concept of life, that this life of competition, starvation, exploitation, selfishness, and breaking down human relation. I mean, because, you know, now we are all, you know, secluded, or many of us, in our homes, certainly not all. But at the same time, this is a way in which capitalism wants to organize our life, to separate us from each other. And I think in Latin America, a lot of people have understood that, no, that it was for collective organizing, it's for collective labor, placing our reproduction in common, like the, you know, the collective kitchens, for instance, all the things for the children, if the committee to ensure the children have a glass of milk every day, el merendero, the public garden. I've met women who organize the whole community in Buenos Aires, in a very, very popular area where there's no social services. And they did that after so many people died of dengue fever. And they realized that, my God, the reason people are dying is because the conditions of reproduction are horrible. And they began to work collectively with a really, really very impressive result.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Silvia Federici. She is the author of Revolution at Point Zero, Housework, Reproduction, and Feminist Struggle. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Silvia. Thank you very much.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com.
T'es pas une autre, t'es un homme, oh nom à moi. Suis pas une autre, suis une femme, ta femme à toi. Et cet amour qui voit le jour entre nos bras restera notre jusqu'au jour où tout partira. Tu viens d'ailleurs, je suis jeudi, tu es dimanche. J'aime les fleurs, tu aimes les pluies et les nuits blanches. Tu m'es venu, d'ailleurs je ne t'attendais plus. Et tu es moi jusqu'au jour où tu partiras. Ne demande pas comment, ne demande pas pourquoi. Dis-moi seulement, je t'aime, mon amour. Ce grand amour qui se veut être le premier, ce grand amour qui se veut être le dernier. Fragile au pluie, le jour entre nos bras restera notre jusqu'au jour où tu partiras.
Hey, dreams up higher than you could fly. I remember you, hey little bird, perched in the southern sun. Those were the days when your feathers were new, and I remember you, little bird. Now you know where you're at, now the clouds are your habitat, but more than that, now when you are a peacock indeed. So flash your colors and I will sing. Glide into time with the moon on your wing. Little bird, little bird, little bird, like a
can be heaven or countless oceans far from me. So, little bird, take my blessing to the stars above you and scatter my wishes to the ones who love you. Take off often on a trip transcendent and sink in the waves and then rise resplendent. Fly with your friends in a V formation and sing to the flocks from your vantage station. Out in the stars beyond a hell's dominion and rest at my feet in between migrations. Little
C K K
U
T T 90.3 FM.
Another reliable communication channel.
Alerte rouge. La propagation de la COVID-19 est à un niveau critique dans votre région ou une région à proximité. Les rencontres d'amis ou de famille sont interdites et les déplacements vers d'autres régions sont non recommandés. Des mesures plus restrictives et ciblées ont été mises en place pour freiner la propagation et éviter un reconfinement. Informez-vous sur québec.ca/coronavirus. Continuez de vous laver les mains, de garder une distance de 2 mètres et de porter un masque lorsque la distanciation physique n'est pas possible. On doit réagir maintenant. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
1, 2, 3, 4...